that doesn't have anything to do with a bill that's supposed to repair the damage done by a hurricane on the East Coast.
Fisheries disaster aid for Alaska may be removed from a relief bill in Congress. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the larger lessons from the case of an Alaska soldier who committed suicide after being subjected to racially charged abuse.
I think the American public needs to take hazing, bullying, abuse of all forms in the military very seriously.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Alaska provisions in a relief bill for states affected by Hurricane Sandy are coming under scrutiny. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, some senior Republican senators want to strip aid for the fishery disaster.
The bill is a priority of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. He says senators must understand the upper chamber will not recess for Christmas until the relief package is finished. Here he is speaking on the Senate floor Monday.
We have an opportunity to help make families and communities whole again. I hope my colleagues on both sides of the aisle will join in moving quickly to send aid to those affected by Sandy as they continue to recover and rebuild.
The problem is, not all of the money is pegged for Sandy. Arizona Senator John McCain says he wants the Senate to vote to include or strip the $150 million allocated for fishery disasters. The money would go to Alaska, states in the Northeast, and the Gulf Coast. And none of it, says McCain, meets muster.
That doesn't have anything to do with a bill that's supposed to repair the damage done by a hurricane on the East Coast.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration approved the three regions that would receive the money. The fishery disaster declared in the Northeast was for damage not yet done. Senator Lisa Murkowski says Alaska's need is more pressing. She says the Appropriations Committee is determining levels of damage, designating regions as in need of immediate help, help in the near term, or money down the road.
If the need is now, if those families who were damaged are hurting, and the need is now, let's figure out a way to provide for that relief.
Conservative groups are now coming out against the aid bill, saying it sends too much money to too many projects that are not in immediate need. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A Fort Wainwright-based soldier implicated in a hazing case is being discharged from the Army. Lieutenant Daniel L. Schwartz is the last of eight Stryker Brigade members charged related to physical and verbal abuse that resulted in the suicide of an Army private last year in Afghanistan. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Private Danny Chen had only been at a forward operating base in Afghanistan for a couple of months when he was found dead in a guard tower of a self-inflicted gunshot. The 19-year-old New Yorker of Chinese descent had been subject to weeks of racially charged abuse from fellow soldiers after being deployed as a replacement with the Fort Wainwright-based Stryker Brigade. His platoon leader, Lieutenant Daniel L. Schwartz, the only officer charged in the Chen case, faced multiple counts of dereliction of duty for failing to prevent the abuse. An Army press release says Lieutenant Schwartz requested an administrative alternative to a court-martial trial at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Fort Bragg spokesman Ben Abel says Schwartz's commander granted what's called an Article 15.
Generally, Article 15 is used when the behaviors or the crimes are of a lesser nature or are general enough in nature that they don't fit a specific crime.
Schwartz avoided a court-martial and potential sentence, but Abel says the lieutenant's Army career is over.
The Article 15 was administered, and the officer was referred for separation from the Army.
Abel says the nature of Lieutenant Schwartz's discharge is under review as part of the separation process and could not comment on the status of any military benefits he might be entitled to or lose. The resolution of the Schwartz case marks the end of proceedings against soldiers related to the hazing of Private Chen. The seven others faced more serious charges, including negligent homicide, manslaughter, and assault, and were sentenced earlier this year to various punishments, including up to 6 months in jail, hard labor, rank reduction, forfeited pay, fines, and military discharge. The Army says officials consulted the Chen family prior to the government accepting Schwartz's Article 15 request. Tom Hayashi, president of the Organization of Chinese Americans National Chapter, says the military justice process has brought little satisfaction.
I think that there's been more disappointment, quite frankly, than satisfaction by not only our organization, but also the community at large. I think is quite disappointed by the outcomes of all eight cases, including that of Mr. Schwartz.
Hayashi calls the sentences a slap on the hand. He says the Chen hazing case has elevated a broader problem that needs to be addressed.
I think the American public needs to take hazing, bullying, abuse of all forms to the military very seriously. We have known this to be a serious problem with even things like sexual assault as well, which has gotten a lot of media's attention, in addition to the hazing case of Danny Chen. Clearly, this is not just an Asian Pacific American issue or race-related issue.
Hayashi advocates changes to the military code of justice for how abuse cases are adjudicated. He wants elected officials and military leaders held accountable for ensuring all individuals in the military are protected, saying it ultimately comes down to the quality of national security. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Ross.
The U.S. Census Bureau has released a long-awaited report that includes the latest census data for the Alaska Native population. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Last week, the American Indian and Alaska Native Population 2010 report was released, and it puts the total population at around 5.2 million people. That's just 1.7% of the total population in the country. The data in the new report shows that the American Indian and Alaska Native population increased by about 27% from the year 2000 to 2010, which far outpaced the 9.7% growth in the total population. The way American Indian and Alaska Native people can report themselves has changed in recent years, including the ability to report themselves as multiple races. The data in the new report shows that nearly half of the American Indian and Alaska Native population reported being multiple races. Only 2.9 million people identified themselves as American Indian and Alaska Native alone, while 2.3 million people reported being American Indian and Alaska Native in combination with one or more races. The 2010 census data shows that 41% of the American Indian and Alaska Native population lived in the western part of the country. That's down from the 43% that lived in the west back in the year 2000. The new report shows that 138.3 thousand American Indian and Alaska Native people lived in Alaska in 2010. That's up 16% compared to the year 2000. That means that Native people make up over 24% of the total Alaska population. The data shows that 12% of the population of Anchorage characterized themselves as American Indian or Alaska Native. There are some interesting stats in the new report. For instance, in 2010, there were only 78,000 American Indian or Alaska Native people that lived in Alaska Native Village statistical areas out of a total population of over 242,000 people. That means that over 164,000 people that live in those areas do not consider themselves American Indian or Alaska Native. The new report puts the total population of the Dillingham, Alaska Native Village statistical area at 2.3 thousand. Over 1,500 of those people label themselves as American Indian or Alaska Native. In the Bethel statistical area, the Native population is counted at just over 4.3 thousand out of a total population of just over 6 thousand. The new report shows that over 33.8 thousand people fall into the Yupik tribal grouping and over 19,000 fall into the Aleut tribal grouping. The new report can be found on the website of the U.S. Census Bureau. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Homer has more trouble with Buccaneer Energy.
They assured us every way that they could that the city would be paid and they would be current as soon as they possibly could.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Friday's shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut has raised questions for teachers and parents across the country. How do you help children understand what happened, and how do you make them feel safe at their own school? It's a conversation taking place in many homes and classrooms this week, including those in Sitka. School district officials are meeting with police to review security procedures. Teachers, meanwhile, are trying to maintain a routine in the classroom, but also be responsive to students who might need to talk about what happened. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Each week inside room 11 at Keetkushaheen Elementary School, teacher Margie Esquiro and her second graders have a class meeting.
Where we talk about classroom rules, being safe, being responsible, being respectful, school rules, bullying, anything that comes up. And
on Monday, she showed up for work.
I was very nervous this morning.
And decided that she would wait to see if any of her students mentioned what happened at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut.
No one brought up the incidents that happened on Friday. And so I thought, okay. And I had talked to a couple moms and got the impression over the weekend that some families talked a lot with their children and some didn't. Some kids heard about it and were totally oblivious. And you just have to pay attention to the age of the kids.
Monday's conversation, she said, was much more general about appropriate friendships and getting along with other people. But at Keet and at other Sitka schools, students and staff have talked about safety before.
We practice lockdown drills at every one of our buildings.
Steve Bradshaw is superintendent of schools in Sitka. He says one of the drills just happened Friday at Sitka High School. The only exception, he said, is at Baranoff Elementary School, which houses kindergarten and first grades.
At Baranoff, we don't practice with the students in the building just because we're concerned about the maturity of the student at that level, but we do practice with the teachers there.
Bradshaw says police have stepped up patrols around Sitka's five school buildings and that the principals and police will meet on Tuesday to discuss security procedures. Back at Keetkushaheen, Principal Casey Demert is sitting on the stage in the lunchroom.
We are kind of towards the tail end of lunch. Fifth graders are just finishing up and heading outside to enjoy the snow.
This school day is really not that much different than any other this year. If anything, that's because of what happened Friday, not in spite of it.
One of the things that's really important, too, is that we kind of continue with our daily routines. We ask teachers to keep an eye on their kids, of course, and if some are really struggling with things, we have excellent school counselors that are available, you know, to really help kids process through the feelings that they might have.
And that takes us back to Margie Esquiro's second grade classroom. The school day came and went without much talk of Connecticut or shootings or tragedy. But Esquiro says that in the days ahead, her 7- and 8-year-old students will probably start getting curious.
So I guess we'll just see what happens because it's not going to go away in the media. It's going to be on the radio. Now kids will start talking about it.
To each other.
And that happens on the playground. Kids will start talking about it, and then they'll come in with something they heard. And then we'll just deal with it as it happens.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Buccaneer Energy has experienced another setback in its efforts to deploy the Endeavor jackup rig, which has been docked at the Homer Harbor about 4 months longer than originally planned. As KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, the company was forced to replace the operator of the rig after local workers complained about not being paid.
Buccaneer Energy fired the company charged with operating the Endeavor jackup rig Friday after learning that local subcontractors were not being paid for work on the rig. Jay Marakis of JMR Worldwide, Buccaneer's public relations office, told Brian Smith of the Peninsula Clarion Friday that company officials decided to sever ties with Archer Drilling Company on Thursday. Calls and emails placed to Archer Drilling from the Clarion seeking comment were not immediately returned. Maracas said Buccaneer had entered into a letter of intent Friday with Spartan Offshore Drilling, the company that currently operates the Spartan 151 jackup rig in Cook Inlet, to take over operating the Endeavor. Maracas said Buccaneer considers itself, quote, paid in full to Archer, with the exception of some disputed amounts for work that has been done. He could not provide details on that debt. Maracas says Buccaneer will work to make sure Homer-based contractors and others who worked on the rig who are owed money by Archer are paid for their services. Homer Harbormaster Brian Hawkins said he watched an exodus of workers loading up and leaving the rig last week. He estimated about 50 construction workers, pipe fitters, welders, and other contractors were employed on the rig. Homer City Manager Walt Reedy said the announcement got the city's attention and prompted a Friday morning teleconference with Buccaneer officials. Reedy said he came away from the conference feeling it was just a, quote, short-term shakeup. Reedy told KBBI Monday that Buccaneer is also about 6 weeks behind in its payments to the city of Homer.
We had a long discussion about that on Friday, and they assured us every way that they could that the city would be paid and they would be current as soon as they possibly could.
Reedy wouldn't put a dollar amount on what Buccaneer owes the city of Homer, saying he did not wish to embarrass the company, but based on current fees for the use of the Deepwater dock, that amount is at least $75,000. Despite everything, Reedy says the city is glad to have Buccaneer at the dock and is grateful for the economic boost the company has provided. He says he is hopeful that the Homer-based workers would soon be able to return to the Endeavor rig.
Based on our conversation with Buccaneer Friday morning, I think the same contractors will be able to come back on the job. At least that's what we're hoping. I know that the welders, I think, were maybe off the job. I forget how long they were off the job, but they hadn't been paid for a couple of weeks. My understanding is there's some plumbers that were not paid, and maybe some others as well. So I think that they're all expecting to come back, and we hope that's the case.
Reedy says Buccaneer officials told him the Endeavor would be departing Homer for the Cosmopolitan Field near Anchor Point in, quote, a couple of weeks, although there is still work that needs to be performed on the rig and a necessary Coast Guard inspection has yet to take place. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. Enroll now and get a career in less than a year in refrigeration, marine oiler, heavy equipment, or welding. Additional training programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January. This message sponsored by Avtech.
Alaska joined with the rest of the nation yesterday to cast its Electoral College ballots for U.S. President and Vice President. The state has three electoral votes. In a ceremony in Juneau, Christy Babcock of Kenai, Kathleen Miller of Fairbanks, and Christopher Nelson of Anchorage cast and signed their ballots for the Republican nominees. Gail Fanumiai is director of the Alaska Division of Elections.
Their party's nominees, Governor Mitt Romney and Congressman Paul Ryan, received the most votes in Alaska for president and vice president on November 6th.
In Alaska, Romney and Ryan received more than 54% of the popular vote, and President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden about 41%. Nationwide, Romney and Ryan received 206 Electoral College votes, while Obama and Biden got 332. Alaska's Division of Elections is under the supervision of Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell. He told the small group at the formal ceremony that the Electoral College guarantees small states like Alaska have more impact on the presidential election.
With Alaska's three electoral votes right here out of a total of 538 nationally, Alaskans have a 0.5% impact on the election. It doesn't sound like much, I agree. But if the election is calculated by popular vote, Alaskans have about 300,000 eligible voters out of 200 million eligible voters nationally, or about a 0.15% impact. So the Electoral College more than triples our collective impact on elections.
The electors are selected by their political party. Christy Babcock applied last spring at the Alaska Republican Party convention. She called it an honor to participate in the Electoral College process and believes it's important to the state.
It is a way to give every state its say. And for Alaska, the Electoral College does ensure that its opinion, its vote, has a little more weight than it would if it were just lost to larger states.
The Electoral College votes were sealed and will be sent to the U.S. Senate President, who is Vice President Biden. Next month, he will read the results of all 50 states and District of Columbia electoral votes to both houses of Congress. It's the last day of voting for Petersburg's mail-in borough election. Ballots have to be postmarked by today. If the vote passes, the city government would dissolve and become a borough government with taxation and planning authority over an area that's about 83 times the size of the current city boundary. The total population gain would be roughly 10%. There are some substantial private land holdings, but most of the additional area is uninhabited national forest land. The city and borough of Juneau submitted a petition to annex some of the same territory, and it's mounted a legal challenge over that issue. The State Division of Elections is administering the vote by mail and expects to post unofficial results online this evening. The target date for certifying the election is January 3rd. The division will continue counting ballots it receives up till then, as long as they are postmarked by today. Southeast game managers are working on new wolf control programs for Southeast Alaska. The state's Board of Game will hear about the plan when it meets next month in Sitka. The Department of Fish and Game is looking at reducing wolves near Petersburg and Ketchikan to help boost deer numbers. Predator control efforts are underway in other parts of the state, but these new programs would be the first of their kind in decades for Southeast. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
One program would take place in a portion of State Game Management Unit 3, which includes the islands around Petersburg, where deer harvests have dropped over the past decade. That includes Petersburg's home island, Mitkoff. Despite a short two-week one-buck hunting season here, Fish and Game Area wildlife biologist Rich Lowell says the harvest numbers have not improved.
For example, in 2000, there were an estimated 169 deer taken on Mitkoff. And in 2009, that fell to an estimated harvest of just 13 deer. So we're looking at ways that we can help get this deer population off the ground, and we feel that reducing predation on deer is probably the best tool we have in our toolbox right now.
Across the Wrangell Narrows from Petersburg on Kuprinoff Island's Lindenberg Peninsula, deer harvests have also dropped precipitously in the past decade. Fish and Game wants the Board of Game to shorten the season on the eastern side of that island to mirror the season and bag limits for Mitkoff. The department blames the deer decline on several factors, including several snowy winters, the loss of habitat through logging, competition from an increased moose population, and predation by both wolves and black bears. Since 2005, the overall harvest for Unit 3 has failed to reach an annual objective of 900 deer set by the Board of Game. Meanwhile, hunting and trapping numbers for wolves in the area have increased. Lowell says the wolf harvest has averaged around 50 a year, but spiked to 97 last year, the highest in at least three decades.
So that's one of the things that leads us to believe that we have pretty high wolf abundance here, and then that is a factor that's contributing to our low deer numbers. And anecdotally, whether you talk to hunters in Unit 3 or biologists with state and federal staff, that they would, you know, suggest that, yeah, we're seeing a lot of wolf sign. People are encountering a lot of wolves incidentally. Our wolf population clearly looks to be, you know, pretty high here right now.
State law on intensive management of wildlife requires the Board of Game to consider reductions or eliminations of hunting seasons, also liberalized hunting and trapping seasons for predators, and habitat improvement projects before it considers predator control. Lowell points out that reduced deer hunting seasons are already in place, or in the case of Lindenberg, under consideration by the board. He notes that wolf hunting seasons have already been lengthened, And he says much of the land in the area is federally owned national forest, so state-sponsored habitat improvement projects are limited.
If the aforementioned actions do not or are unlikely to achieve the intensive management population and harvest objectives, the board must consider predator control.
The department has drafted a feasibility analysis for trapping wolves in the Petersburg area, and Lowell admits there's no certainty that wolf control will work.
We're not sure we can reduce wolf numbers sufficiently within a portion of Unit 3 to have an impact on the deer population.
As proposed, the program would have the state hiring one or two trappers to target wolves along the shoreline during the wintertime, but would not seek to kill all of the wolves in the area. Meanwhile, two groups, Greenpeace and the Center for Biological Diversity, in 2011 petitioned for protection of southeast wolves under the Endangered Species Act. They argue that the region's wolves are at risk of extinction.
It seems very unscientific to start any predator control program without scientific data.
Tina Brown of Juneau is the president of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance's organization in the state and says very little is known about southeast wolves.
If predator control is to be implemented, there has to be an extreme need for it. It has to be done on a scientific basis in the smallest area possible, taking the least amount of wildlife or targeted species possible. That almost never occurs.
A similar program that could eliminate all wolves from Gravina Island near Ketchikan is also under consideration. The next step would be developing an operational plan for trapping, and finally, regulatory language that the Board of Game would have to approve. If the board does approve, it could be next winter at the earliest before state-sponsored wolf trapping is underway. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, and Matt Lichtenstein and Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Quality Inn and Suites on Spinard, close to the airport in downtown Anchorage, offering Wi-Fi, a hot continental breakfast, and a 24-hour airport shuttle. Reservations at 243-3131.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.